Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us on iTunes or download our podcasts at restaurantguysradio.com.
And don't forget, you can also now follow us on Twitter at Restaurant Guys. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. Until I incorporate that, though, you're going to do that every day.
That's okay. I'm the Twitter guy. I'm the twit. Anyway, don't jump on that. That was low-hanging fruit. I want to talk about the lunch, the wonderful luncheon that we were privileged, and I mean privileged, to be invited to just last week. It was tremendous. It was at the Lincoln. That's the new restaurant in Lincoln Center. Beautiful restaurant. Great food.
Jonathan
wonderful
Benno's
service.
Chef, really.
Oh, fantastic. But it wasn't just the place. And I've been in there for drinks before, but never had dinner. And I was happy to have lunch. It was terrific. It was the subject of the meal. We were invited by George Faison, who's been a guest on this show. Mm-hmm. Who's a big guy. He's in a meat butcher company called DeBraga and Spittler. And he's just someone who writes well. He has a great product, and we buy from him and many other.
We did a show with George a few months back, if you wanted to.
And he's a real advocate for humane methods of animal husbandry, mm-hmm. and for producing the tastiest, best, and most nutritious meat products in the world that are environmentally sustainable.
George distributes a product called Nyman Ranch, which some of you heard us talk about on the show, and they were celebrating their 700th. Farmer
associated
that
they've with
brought
the network.
On board in that food network.
Nicolette Hahn Nyman's been on the show before. Has Bill been on the show? Bill Nyman's been on the show before.
Yes, he has.
Yeah, Bill Nyman's been on the show before. If you look in the old archives, I don't think he's any longer associated with the project, but he was the founder of it. Mm-hmm. And they put together farmers who are doing things right and doing things well and need to charge a little more for it, with consumers who are willing to pay for it. And these guys were really pioneers, because for a while you had a lot of consumers who wanted to eat that way and were willing to pay for it. And you had producers who were willing to go to the extra steps to produce that way. But, you know, beef isn't grain that you can put in a silo for a year. You got to sell it, you know, when you harvest it. And it's a little more complicated than that. And the Nyman Ranch Network really helped that happen. And George Faison, in his last company, he was working with them, and he's really brought DeBraga and Spittler up to about 35% of what they are selling now as far as meat products is really sustainably raised. And that's a meaningful term with them. And so we had this lunch where we went with the various farmers that supply Nyman Ranch, various other sorts of farmers, journalists
from
all over.
Very interesting event with some really intelligent people speaking intelligently about the subject.
Fred Kirschenman is the chairman of Stone Barns. He spoke mm-hmm. really eloquently and really powerfully about the whole food paradigm and how it simply got to change and some ways that it really can change. And that since the current thing is unsustainable, it's going to come crashing in around our head anyway. And if, you know, if we choose how we change it, or we just run out and then have to change it's going to change.
He gave one of those great statistics of, you know, how we've changed in agriculture and how fossil fuel driven our agriculture has become.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
How at one time, you know, we were, for every kilocalorie of energy we put into our farms and taking care of our agriculture, we got 10 food kilocalories out of it. And now it's the opposite.
Right. We put 10 kilocalories of energy in for every calorie of food we get out.
All right, so let me help you with the math there. It's 100 times different.
Right, and let me help you with the math there. Right. It's not sustainable because you're expending more energy than you're getting by farming. The thing about it is that people who farm that way are able to externalize their costs.
Well, until another 6 million years when all human beings become petroleum.
Right, then, right. Then you're eating, but we're mining yeah. the oil, and we're eating it. We're using those calories. It's crazy. And he also talked about the real society. When you look at it, it is not more profitable to farm this way.
Right.
It's just that the people who are farming that way and selling that way and buying that way and eating that way aren't paying for the polluted river, the polluted ocean,
right.
the lack of topsoil. What have we lost? Is it 38% of American topsoil?
We have to have him on the show because he had so many great and interesting facts and anecdotes about how we're treating the world in order to
to do these. It's inane. It's inane the way we farm.
It's insane.
Yes, it's insane. I agree. It's also inane. I just don't understand how. Like, I understand how we started doing it. You know, we had a lot of, you know, we had an abundance of oil and products and those types of fossil fuels and energies. I don't understand why we're not working our way out of it now.
Because there's a lot of money to be made in the system if you can externalize the costs. Mm-hmm. The profits are private sector. The costs are public, right? Mm-hmm. So the profits go to the individual that produces the food. Now, if in the net-net, once you calculate in, okay, well, if you farm differently, then you wouldn't lose 40% of the topsoil in America, which has got to be worth $20 billion. And you wouldn't pollute the aquifer. You wouldn't deplete the aquifers, which has got to be worth $20 billion. And you wouldn't pollute the Gulf of Mexico and have a dead zone the size of the state of Rhode Island or sometimes Texas, depending on the time of year. And that's got to be worth $20 billion of damage. Well, guess what? If the people who are producing and consuming that way had to pay that, well, then it's not more economical.
Right, it's way less more expensive.
But they make other people pay for it, and they get to take their share of the profits.
I mean, just and to, you know, to kind of buttress Francis's point, if you said, okay, I will give you a portion of the ocean the size of Rhode Island, how much will you pay me for it?
Right. Okay. Exactly. How much do you pay in taxes for that? How much do you pay everybody else who can't fish there, who can't swim there, if some breeds go extinct, which other people could have hunted and fished, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're taking other people's stuff, okay? This is not like, you know, yeah, I'm all for individual rights. My right to swim in the ocean, right? My mm-hmm. right to get my food out of the ocean and by fishing. You know, it's about, you know, your rights extended to swing your fist stops when it comes into contact with my nose. You know, that's where your right to swing your fist ends. Well, anyway, to talk about something similar, to talk about Wagyu beef, which is something that George Faison sells and produces, we have Michael Beattie coming on the show. He is the executive director of the American Wagyu Association. We're going to be talking about an article that Larry Olmsted wrote in Forbes magazine. There's a bit of controversy about what is Kobe, what is Wagyu, and we asked Mr. Beattie to come on the show to clarify for us. I'm looking forward to it because I've got some questions that need answering myself. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com and iTunes. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. And today we welcome to our show Michael Beattie. Michael is the executive director of the American Wagyu Association. He was the head of the Australian Wagyu Association. And for all things bovine, he's going to be our expert today.
Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, now, there's been some controversy recently. There was an article that came out basically saying there's no such thing as Kobe beef in America. There's no such thing as Wagyu beef in America. It was an incendiary article by Larry Olmsted in Forbes. And, you know, he basically said there is no such – you're being ripped off if you're buying Wagyu beef. You wrote an excellent response to that article. And then he responded to your response, and this is something that's a little bit confusing for or maybe even a lot confusing for consumers who care about their food.
I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit confused, Michael.
This is a radio show for people who care about their food, whether we're buying it for themselves or sourcing it for others. So let's talk about what is the definition of Wagyu beef.
Well, let's start with Kobe. Let's start with
Kobe.
Okay.
I mean. Look, I think it was a matter of time that, you know, people probably had raised the issue. The reality is what made Kobe beef famous is Wagyu. I mean, it is Wagyu in its purest term or in layman's terms, translates to Japanese cow. Every prefecture or state in Japan, breeds Wagyu cattle. And the definition of Wagyu, as I said, is Japanese cow, but the Breed Society in Japan basically identifies four types. You've got the Japanese black, the Japanese brown or red cattle, which is also known as Akaushi. Akaushi in Japanese just means red cow, a Japanese pole and Japanese shorthorn. And in the Hyogo Prefecture, which is where Kobe beef comes from, that's what it is. I think years gone by, Kobe were very effective in marketing their Wagyu beef, and certainly outside Japan. And I think they were probably one of the first to obviously export beef to the U.S. Many years ago. And the name Kobe really stuck with people's minds. Well, this is Kobe beef. But it really is Wagyu. That's what it does come down to. But
well,
the true term, the reality is that for it to be Kobe beef, it has to come from Kobe in Japan or from the Hyogo Prefecture. And so what we're seeing nowadays is that, no, the Wagyu beef produced here in the U.S. is not from Kobe, Japan. And Olmsted is absolutely correct in that that is true, but it's still Wagyu beef.
So in the article, he says that if you live in the United States, and he says this, if you live in the United States, unless you've gone to Japan, you've never tasted Kobe beef.
I had been to restaurants
5 or 10 years ago before Japanese beef was banned in the United States, and I ate things that were called Kobe beef. Is it possible that they were Kobe beef?
It is possible it was Kobe beef. I believe Kobe did export beef into the U.S., but as did other prefectures, I'm sure. I'm not an expert on meat exports, especially into the U.S., as I've only been here for a bit over 12 months. But, I'm sure there was some product that was Kobe. But, a lot of it was probably Wagyu beef produced here in the U.S. And again, it depends on the grade of that beef, too. We categorize our breed in our registry system from a full blood, which is 100% Wagyu, and then derivatives of that all the way down to percentage cattle and F1s and so forth. And I can talk more about that later.
Well, let's just dial it back for our guests. I think one of the best analogies to have come up in this argument is that to call something Kobe beef, which does not come from the Kobe Prefecture, you can do that in the United States and in Australia because we don't recognize, sadly, in the United States, American law doesn't recognize the patents that the legitimate patents that the Kobe has to subscribe to in Japan and in many other countries around the world that do recognize those patents. So the analogy would be champagne.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I'd like to take that analogy all the way out because you can buy something in the United States called champagne. You can't buy champagne in Europe unless it is from the region of Champagne. And subscribes to
their
quality standards, right?
That is no different in Australia. We have to call it sparkling wine.
Well,
that's what it is. It's not champagne. So.
Well, and in America, sadly, because we don't recognize the French patent on the word champagne, or the French trademark, not patent, the French trademark on the word champagne, you can call your sparkling wine from California made from different grapes, champagne.
I
think there was a good article raised, and I think that people would be wise to be careful about using the term Kobe in America, because as people have become more aware of what's out there, the quality producers of sparkling wine in the United States do not use the word champagne.
Exactly.
But they make wine, in the same realm of quality of champagne from the same grapes using the same methods. And, I think that maybe that is more akin to Wagyu than, to sparkling wine being
right.
The genius.
What they say is sparkling wine method champenoise instead of saying champagne.
Right.
Okay. Well, as a breed society, we certainly don't encourage our members to use the term Kobe beef. I mean, we don't mention it anywhere on our website, in our publications. It's very much, like I said, it's a term that obviously in those early days when product was coming into the U.S., people knew it as Kobe beef, and I've done it here. I've gone out and spoken to people here, and 9 out of 10 people have no idea what Wagyu is, but a majority of those people have heard of Kobe.
Right.
And I guess it's our job is to try and educate the marketplace that, the breed is, this is Wagyu beef, and that's what we've got ahead of us to do that.
Well, I'm going to say as well, in my restaurant, I've used the word Kobe not to say that I'm serving Kobe beef, but to try and make analogies to what's happening here. That they're American cattle, but
there are similarities.
And there's some similarities, exactly.
Well, the one of the things that I guess I had to reiterate to Larry and explain to him is that we're one of the few breeds excuse me, that we had to, we actually DNA type for parentage on our 100% Wagyu cattle. And the same goes for in Australia when we did that as well. Very few breed societies had done that from the beginning, and we felt that to maintain integrity, because our population was quite small, it was that we just had to make sure that, and because the intrinsic value of the carcasses, because you know, these animals are obviously raised a little bit differently to other breeds and fed much longer than you would see other domestic, you know, Angus, your Herefords, Shorthorns and so forth that are going through a feedlot system. So it was important that this is what it is. And through DNA typing, and, you know, we have been doing that now for probably over 15 years, you are getting what you're getting when it comes to a full-blood animal. And that piece of paper is so important to us. And
so how does the consumer know? How does the consumer know that they're getting a full-blood Wagyu beef?
Look, it's difficult because from a breed society, we can obviously put rules and regulation as to people registering their cattle. But when it goes through the process of animals being fed and then slaughtered and on-sold through wholesalers and retailers to restaurateurs, as a breed society, we don't have anything in place to follow or track that process. I know some breeders do that. I guess the wholesalers and retailers and obviously the restaurateurs have an obligation to obviously find out where the product's coming from and what it is and so forth. And I think truth in labelling is very important. It's becoming more important these days. And, as a consumer, I'd like to know that if I'm going to be paying $100 for a steak, I want to be sure that that's what it is.
Well,
and,
I think we have the same issue with how do you know it's real olive oil from Italy? How do you know it's balsamic vinegar?
Yeah.
How do you know it's real balsamic vinegar? And how do you know it's the salmon is wild salmon?
Yeah.
And I think that, like wild salmon, good Kobe beef, know, it has a character.
Sorry, you want to say Wagyu beef.
Wagyu beef. I said Kobe. That's horrible. Good Wagyu beef has a character all its own that
it
you
does.
Know, you can see. And also, I think as a consumer, I mean, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. If there's a Wagyu steak on the menu and it's
$32, right.
$15 or $20, it's not, you know?
Well, the reality is, and again, it comes back to truth and labeling, it could be a Wagyu-infused animal, it could be a F1, but at the end of the day, I think it's all about meat quality, and believe you me, off a high-percentage Wagyu animal, you can produce a very good carcass, but I guess it comes back to, and it's important to understand why this animal was bred for in the first place. And the differences between what happens in Japan and outside Japan. The Australian industry and then the US industry is very similar. But in Japan, for example, and I'm probably just jumping ahead of myself here, but you either have Wagyu, which is 100% Wagyu as a breed, or you have domestic bred cattle, which typically is your Wagyu cross primarily with the your dairy breeds, with your Holstein, maybe with some Angus cattle. Here in the US, as Australia, because the numbers were so small when they were originally brought into the country, a lot of animals were graded up. So they started off crossing, and then they slowly moved from a first cross, second cross, third cross, fourth cross. And so there's a lot of purebred animals out there that are not 100% Wagyu, but can still produce an excellent carcass. And maybe not producing a BMS-12 as you would see in Japan, but I guess it's also our palate too. As a Western meat lover, we don't probably need a BMS-12. It's that level of marbling is so rich.
You're using some expressions that I think our listeners have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
You said BMS-12. You used the expression F1 earlier. I just want to clarify what some of those things are.
Okay, so when I refer to as an F1, it's a first cross, so it's 50% Wagyu or of another breed crossed with an Angus. So what you do is on an F1, it's half Wagyu, half Angus, and then so the progeny. So if you get a heifer progeny, a female progeny from that, so it's 50% Wagyu, You go and put another Wagyu bull over her, she becomes an F2. So it becomes 75% Wagyu. And then if you have heifer progeny that you breed to her, it becomes an F3 or 87.5%. And then you can go to the fourth cross and it becomes 93.75%. And that typically in the cattle world is known as a purebred animal. And then typically a lot of breeds recognize that, well, a purebred is obviously, that's what the breed is. It's now known as, you know, Hereford or Angus or Shorthorn or another breed. In Wagyu, because there is what the term full blood, and Wagyu really is the only breed that refers to as a full blood, that's 100%. So you can have F8s and F9s or higher that become 99.999% Wagyu, but they'll never not be known as 100% Wagyu.
So is there a minimum percentage that the purebred Wagyu has to be to get there?
93.75% Wagyu.
That's pretty reasonable.
It's referred to as a high percentage or high content Wagyu animal. So, and you honestly, you can produce a very good carcass from a purebred animal, because having that introduction of another breed from the beginning, you're adding a bit of hybrid vigor, which is probably a term that your listeners aren't known to, but what hybrid vigor is all about is adding some of the positive traits from another breed that have been infused into, in this case, the Wagyu. And even though it'll be probably diluted, some of those positive traits are still coming through, even at that level of breeding with the Wagyu. So
I will tell you that I think the term purebred to the public is a little bit confusing if you don't know that the term, you know, full blood or 100% Wagyu exists as well.
Absolutely, and I think it's the way the English language is, you know, it comes about. We immediately to the unknown person, they would think that they would, and I've seen it where they've put the purebred ahead of full blood. And it's actually the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, the full blood is 100% Wagyu. And as here as in Australia, a purebred will never be treated as 100% Wagyu. It can be very high, and in some cases, depending on some meat programs, there have been situations where you've got that level of breeding, but I think it's very important to distinguish the two, that no, full blood is 100%, purebred can be, you know, almost up there, but it's not quite as high. Now, it's very important to understand that we're not necessarily talking about meat quality. We can have purebreds that can outperform a full blood, but typically, you know, you will see on your full blood animals probably a consistency of a higher level of marbling. But it depends on what your consumer is after. If they're after a very highly marbled piece of meat that in an Asian cuisine or Asian dish that you're presenting, you know, 2 to 4 ounces of beef, then yes. But if you want to sit down and have a 12-ounce steak, you wouldn't want to be eating a really highly marbled piece of meat because it would be like eating butter.
Yeah,
it's so rich.
I actually am a decadent sort of fellow, so
I've
had an 8-ounce one of those. How much 100% Wagyu stock is there in America? Do you have an idea of that? How much full how many full bloods are there here? Or what kind of production do we see?
That's a very good question. I mean, because, you know, unlike some countries where it is mandatory that all animals have to be registered, we don't do that here in the U.S. Look, at a guess, I would think there's probably 3,000 to 4,000 breeding full blood female here in the U.S. There's a lot of crossbred cattle, a lot of high content cattle. And some of the more prominent Wagyu producers like Washington Beef or Snake River Farms, which you may be familiar with, they have a lot of high-content Wagyu, a lot of F1 products, so their Angus Wagyu cross, which they feed for a considerable time, and they're producing a very good meat product from that particular cross. And I believe... and again, this is my view. I think the biggest impact this breed will make here in the U.S. Is in meat quality, improving, raising the bar on meat quality and consistency. but its biggest impact will be in crossbreeding. And there will always be a niche market for the 100% and purebred markets to produce really high-end product for the restaurant trade. But I think the American consumer is really looking for a consistent meat product. I mean, we love our red meat, and it's nothing more frustrating to go to a butcher shop or a supermarket, and one week you buy a Cryovac of strip and it's great, and then the next week or month later you go and buy another piece, and the quality is not quite there. And I think that's one thing our breed can offer, is that meat quality and that consistency.
Let's talk about that for a second, because what I'll tell you is that while all Wagyu that I've had I've enjoyed thoroughly, there is a difference. I mean, depending on where it's produced, who's producing it, where it's coming from, I have seen, significant difference based on producer. I just have.
A lot of it's got to do with the feeding, because you are feeding these animals, anywhere from 350 to 550 days on feed. I mean, that's a long time on feed. That ration is very important. And it also comes down to the type of marbling in the meat. One of the big things that the Japanese are looking for now is that really fine spiderweb type marbling, in the meat. And that's what they strive to achieve. And if you can do that, but it is. It definitely comes down to the ration that you feed these cattle as to a distinct flavor. But it's, the tenderness and that melting point of the fat is very unique to the Wagyu breed. And it's great. I think it's a fantastic piece of meat.
I think that no one would argue that some of the best beef being produced and consumed in the United States right now is being called is Wagyu beef produced domestically here in the United States.
Yeah.
Is there though? Is there any? Is the beef from a full blood Wagyu cow? Is that like what people will have in Japan, or is the Japanese beef is what people have in Japan inherently different?
I would not say inherently different. Again, a lot of it's got to do with the ration. There are people, and I guess forgive my ignorance here. I mean, certainly from my experience in Australia, there were people that were feeding Wagyu cattle based on Japanese rations, and I believe that they are getting input here to some people feeding cattle here using Japanese rations. So,
what are Japanese rations?
Well, obviously there are ingredients going into that ration that you would not normally feed domestic cattle, because typically most cattle fed here, as in Australia, in a domestic situation, are on a fairly hot ration. And what I mean hot is that you want your daily gain, you want these cattle to be putting on weight fairly quickly and on a shorter period of time. So you're talking, probably 80 to 120 days on feed for a typically grain-finished animal here, where, like I said, on a long-fed Wagyu, you're talking over 500 days in some cases of animals, where the ration is not quite as hot, so you have a little bit more roughage in that grain. And so what you're trying to do is you're targeting about 2 pounds a day, about a kilo a day, daily gain. That's the sort of goal that you want to try and achieve. And the Japanese, there are stories where they will massage and use sake and beer and everything else. I think there are some people that would do that, but again, you have to understand that this animal was originally bred as like the farm tractor that pulled the plow, pulled the cart. These were a part of, it was a Buddhist country and probably still is, but for thousands of years, it was forbidden to eat red meat in Japan, eat cattle. So these animals were bred as to pull the plow and cart. And so, the average farm was 10 acres. They had 5 cows. These animals were treated like pets. So they were well looked after. They're like a part of the family. And the other thing in Japan is that there's a lot of small breweries, a lot of, you know, byproducts from those breweries that were actually given to these cattle to be fed. I think it's as much as it's the romance of giving, you know, the cattle a bottle of beer every day. I don't think it does a lot to improving the meat quality. It might, a little bit of alcohol might aid in digestion, but that's about it.
I find it does for me. That's all the time. I just have a little, I would like to do an experiment where we let one cow smoke cigars every once in a while and see what that's just a terrible, terrible joke. Anyway, all right. So one final question I'd love for you to clarify for me, because Olmsted says that Wagyu is not a breed.
Yep.
Is Wagyu a breed?
Well, it is. It is recognized as a... I mean, what do you define as a breed? I mean, you go back thousands of years, there are derivatives of animals crossed with other breeds, and then over time they've stabilized, and now they've been recognized as a breed. I mean, for example, Brangus is crossed between Brahman and Angus. Your Braford is crossed between Brahman and Hereford.
Mm-hmm.
The Wagyu is a stabilized composite. Some of the early known lines of the Wagyu cattle originated in Lake Baikal in Russia thousands of years. And then, you know, there are native lines of Wagyu cattle, but the problem was that they found that the breed was getting smaller and smaller in stature, and about 140 years ago they introduced European breeds into these native lines of Japanese cattle to improve their size and performance, and especially when they started to make these animals more productive for meat production. And then it wasn't until the 1950s when the Japanese formed the Breed Society and recognized that you know, this is a breed. We regard Wagyu as Japanese cow, and so I guess you've got to put it in the context of what is a breed. You've got to look at all breeds. I mean, they've got to start somewhere. I mean,
yeah.
The Aberdeen Angus breed obviously started in Scotland, but at some point it probably was infused with some native cattle from that region and then was stabilized. So that's really...
You know, yeah. I have to say, I think that we've dealt with all of my questions here. I really walked into this not knowing all the answers, and I'm sure we never know all the answers, but I think that you really helped us to clarify the issue. And
look, I'm more than happy to, you know, we can have a follow-up at some point, and, you know, I would just say, and I'm not sure whether I can do this or not, but I could, we've got our annual convention this year in the Pacific Northwest here in beautiful Coeur d'Alene.
And you're gonna fly Mark and I out to do a show there. That's great.
Absolutely. You know, we've got a big focus. One of the important things is about the meat quality. And so we've got a Japanese professor who has worked with developing the grading system in Japan. And he will be our keynote speaker, at this convention in late September. And, I'd certainly welcome your listeners to, just keep an eye out on our website and, if anyone's interested, do come. I mean, one of the big things, too, with our breed is the health benefits. This intramuscular fat is actually has a higher ratio of monounsaturated fat. So, you know, to the housewife who sees a Wagyu steak with all this fat is immediately going to say, gosh, that's not going to be good for my health. But the reality is it's regarded as the healthy fat. And so there's a real health benefit to breeding Wagyu cattle and to be eating Wagyu beef.
And they say there are great health benefits to being happy. And whenever I eat Wagyu beef, I'm happy. So that sort of that works out. All right. But I will say that if you do like Wagyu beef, and you alluded to this earlier, you know, I can eat a 24-ounce steak. I can't eat a 24-ounce Wagyu
Absolutely
steak. You don't want it. It's about being intense, concentrated, and delicious.
Yeah, it is. Putting it in context that you don't need a lot of it. It's all about the experience with the Wagyu. And I'm sure that many of your listeners have tried it. Those who haven't tried it, go out there and try it. I mean, there's some great people producing the beef and selling it. And there's some great restaurants that are really doing a fantastic job. But, you know, as a breed society, it's our job to try and educate the consumer about what our this wonderful breed's all about. And you know, I want our breed to be number one. I think it's got a lot, it has a lot of attributes that no other breed can take away from us. And I think that's the key to this breed. So,
well, Michael, thanks for coming on the show. It's been great to have you, and thanks for clarifying. Michael Beatty is the executive director of the American Wagyu Association. If you want to find out more about him and this issue in general, go to restaurantguysradio.com or write us at mark@restaurantguysradio.com.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back.
We are.
What are we? The Restaurant Guys.
That's
right.
Definitely us.
That was, you know, I have to say, that wasn't the most rip-roarinest, like, cocktail show we ever did, but that was important stuff.
It's an important conversation, you know, that this has been going back and forth now for a couple of months.
And by the way, Larry Olmsted, I think, raised some good points. And I think he's a good writer overall, too, by the way, but I think he's a little over the top on this. He's a little didactic about it, and he's a little over the top.
Well, you know, he's probably been lied to.
Oh, I share his outrage. I share his outrage of being lied to.
Places, you know, where you purchase these things. The answer is always the proof is in the pudding. Okay, go to a place that where you trust them, mm-hmm. taste it, and if you go someplace and it doesn't taste quite like that, maybe it's not exactly what it's supposed to be.
Well, and you know, I, if you want to be philosophical about it, I still, you know, when the places are offering the Kobe sliders for $9 for three burgers, or when they're offering the Kobe, I don't know. I've seen Kobe for all sorts of ridiculous stuff. Usually when I find it, I have it, and I'm like, that's not very good. But if I go to a restaurant, whether the chef is misinformed and he calls something Kobe, but I get it and it's tasty, I still have a problem with it, but I might order it again. But I think it's important that we clarify, just like people used to say, oh, I'll have the California champagne.
Right.
You know, I think it's important that we clarify this.
And I do think that, you know, I don't have a problem, and I've done it myself. I said this earlier in the show. I've done it myself where somebody says, well, what is Wagyu? Well, that's an American style like Kobe beef. You know,
it's like, American beef styled
it's,
like...
It's American beef that's styled like the beef from Japan, and that's really what it is. And but it's different, okay, because I have had Kobe beef from Japan, and I've put it direct... We did a tasting. I remember Red Meat Club years ago. We did a tasting where we had a Kobe steak and an American Wagyu steak next to each other along with a regular Angus steak, and we tasted those things side by side so we could be educated by it. And they're very different. And frankly, I've had some Australian Wagyu that's very different than the American Wagyu.
Sure.
And they're different. And that's the reality is they're different. All delicious in their own way.
Uh-huh.
I really like American Wagyu beef. I'm really a fan.
I'll be honest with you. I still don't get Larry Olmsted's objection to the use of the term Wagyu. I completely concur with his objection to the
word Kobe.
Word Kobe. And I share his outrage. I don't.
Although you occasionally use the word Kobe by mistake.
Although I just, because I know. It's like, give me a bottle of glass of champagne. Sometimes and you know what? As a consumer, sometimes I'll be at the bar and say, I'll just have a glass of champagne. Saying sparkling wine is just a little more cumbersome.
Clumsy.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think it's an important issue. It's something to watch. I think it's something that's going to clarify as time goes by. And what's really important is that whatever words that are used, that the consumer understand what's going on in the end.
Yep.
And is not misled in the end. And I think that's as important to the Wagyu Association. It's as important to the people who own the Kobe trademark in Japan and other producers of American beef. Hope you learned a little something in the hour. I know that we certainly did. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com or iTunes. And remember, tell a friend.